No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about Constitution Day. We're going to be talking about America's founding document, what makes it work, why it's endured as long as it has. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guest is an old friend of the program, Jane Henniger, who is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana. Jane, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here, and I probably should do my standard disclaimer. I think most people know this, but it's good to have it out there, that I was at one time one of Jane's predecessors. They've since traded up, obviously, as executive director of the ACLU of Indiana. We don't want to withhold anything from the audience. So let's talk a little bit about what Constitution Day is first, how it got started, because it's not a holiday that stretches back to the 19th century.
Right. About 10 years ago, Congress required that any school receiving federal funding celebrate Constitution Day. September 17th is designated as Constitution Day because it was the day of the final signing of that document in 1787, if I get my math right.
Yes, yeah, it was 1787. And, you know, what are schools required to do?
It's a very loose requirement, mm-hmm. and we try to give some definition to it, but all Congress requires is that schools do something in celebration recognition of the Constitution. And they can talk about it, they can have share materials, they can have programming, speakers, but they have to recognize the Constitution and hopefully in some way the importance it plays in our everyday lives.
And what sort of activities is the ACLU of Indiana doing here to mark the occasion?
Yeah, I think that ACLU nationally, the affiliates across the country have for a long time tried to celebrate Constitution Day. And as we like to say at our office, every day is Constitution Day for the ACLU because that's our guiding document. But we last year worked in conjunction with the National ACLU to provide a whole host of resources online and through volunteers to schools that might want to use them. And they're adaptable up to college and down to grade school. The documents and materials, a lot of them interactive, that have been designed by National ACLU are designed for middle school kids. But again, they can be adapted to any audience. And adult audiences, we've used them too as well.
I know that periodically social scientists, other researchers play this nasty trick on Americans. They go out and often they'll translate the Bill of Rights into modern language rather than 18th century language and ask them if they would sign off on this as if it were a new proposal. And inevitably the results come back that, you know, somewhere around 2/3 of the people surveyed say, no way, that's far too radical. I think that Constitution Day in part was designed to combat that, to make people realize that this is part of our legacy. Are there any signs that it's working?
It's a long-term, multi-generational process, it'll never end, right? Mm-hmm. And that our history is full of this evolving understanding of the Constitution and our individual roles in it, and that that is by design. I mean, it's a living, breathing document. It's supposed to be about the relationship between citizens and their government, and that, by definition, is going to be dynamic and changing. So that the challenge to keep people informed, keep them as if believing that they have ownership and participation in not only the document. You know, we all, you know, mm-hmm. pledge allegiance and, you know, feel patriotic toward our country. But the real fundamental understanding of what makes the United States of America different from other countries. That's what the Constitution is about, and that's why it's so important. It's a never-ending challenge, but it's one that's essential to our democracy.
We're talking about the Constitution in anticipation of Constitution Day tomorrow here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. What's the biggest misconception people have about the Constitution?
I think a very fundamental a concept that is often fuzzy for people, I'll say that, is who's covered by the Constitution and what behavior is covered by the Constitution. So, you know, we all have a sense that we have rights as citizens, and those come from the Constitution. That we're fuzzy, as you've alluded, on exactly what those rights include. Majority of people don't believe in the free speech as it's played out in reality, but they would say that they have a God-given right to free speech. I think one of the biggest misconceptions is who is governed by those rights and in what relationship. So all the Constitution does is govern our relationship with our government. So take First Amendment free speech. Government can't tell me to shut up. You, John, could tell me to shut up. My boss can tell me what's appropriate to say and not to say on the job. But it's only our government that can't tell us what to say. And it's that's our God-given as American citizens, our right to free speech. It's that relationship between government. And so essentially only the government is controlled by the Constitution. Now, we have laws that have permeated over the centuries from that document into our laws on the state, local, national level. And those laws can go into other relationships between business owners and their customers, between employers and their employees. But the Constitution and the rights and the Bill of Rights, those are between the government and individual citizens.
Yeah, I used to say when I was doing your job, try to boil this down, that the Constitution was a kind of contract under which a free people agreed to be governed, that it set forth the terms in that sense. And I guess what I'd like to ask a bit about here is, a lot of people don't get the whole idea of what is unconstitutional, what isn't. That is a test for any new law that emerges, whether it comports with some portion of the Constitution. Is that fair?
Yeah, and I'd say that's another big area of confusion for everyone, including lawyers all the way down to grade school kids. The Constitution doesn't spell things out in black and white. Mm-hmm. That's part of the reason why, or the role of our judiciary, they have helped interpret the Constitution. Sorry, I'm losing my
your headphones. It's okay. It's not a visual medium, so we're all right.
I've lost my train of thought.
It's okay. When we're talking about courts interpreting.
Right. And the Constitution is something that has to be defined and interpreted based on a set of facts. Mm-hmm. So we have many cases at the ACLU, and our history is full of cases where it's one given set of facts, and that behavior by the government was deemed unconstitutional. If the government changed a few things on either side of that behavior, would it be then unconstitutional? We can't say until that specific set of facts is presented to a court and we ask the question. I'll give you an example. Yeah. We earlier, last year and earlier this year were involved in a case in Evansville, Indiana. The city council had approved a church group that wanted to erect 31 6-foot crosses in a 4-block area along the Riverwalk in Evansville, a very prominent part of their cityscape. They wanted to decorate them, and by children at Vacation Bible School, and put them on this along this stretch. Some citizens contacted us and said, if you put up that many crosses that big in that short of a space, it will appear as if government is endorsing religion, a certain sect of mm-hmm. religion, Christianity, in this perspective. We took up that case. The district court and the court of appeals both agreed that it did cross the line and at least create the appearance of government endorsement of religion, which is contrary to the First Amendment. So part of the question back from members of the public and even of churches is, what would have been permissible if there had been 20 crosses over a 7-block length of space? What if they were only 4 feet tall instead of 6 feet tall? And we don't know. All we know is that the facts that were presented in that specific case were 30-some crosses, 6 feet tall in a 4-block area. I mean, if you can imagine that visually. So I think that's often the challenge, that the Constitution doesn't spell out things in black and white. It allows us, and that's a great thing about our Constitution. Mm-hmm. It's allowed facts and history and context to dictate what it really means, what these rights mean in our everyday lives.
What is the most contentious part of the Constitution right now, the thing that people argue about the most?
Well, I can tell you that I think that it's the origin of the Bill of Rights in lots of ways. It's that the rights in the Constitution, almost by necessity and really by design, protect the minority against the majority. The majority in a democracy doesn't need protection, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they can take care of themselves. And it's the minority, which today's minority could be tomorrow's majority, and history's proven that as well. And so often it's the people who can speak for themselves the least, whether that's children or prisoners or persons with disabilities, racial minorities, minorities of sexual orientation. Historically, there have been all kinds of minorities that, but for the Constitution, wouldn't have the protections that all of the rest of us enjoy. But it's exactly because of that the Constitution has been able to live and breathe. But often, in the heat of a particular moment in history, that can feel controversial, though in hindsight, we see the wisdom of it.
We are talking about the Constitution in anticipation of Constitution Day tomorrow. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. How many of when you talk about these programs, I mean, how many people do you get the sense just haven't encountered the Constitution at all? And please tell me they're not on the bench. But
that's, right. Okay. Right. Well, we hope, right, that if our educational system works, that everyone has encountered the Constitution, whether they remember it, whether they were paying attention, we can't always say. But clearly, some people have a stronger sense of it than others. There have been many people, including one of our Sheila Kennedy, who's had our position, your predecessor. Now she's fighting the fight for civic education, trying to address these woeful statistics at the amount of knowledge that people have about the Constitution.
We are talking about the Constitution, U.S. Constitution, in anticipation of Constitution Day tomorrow. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. Or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. My guest is Jane Henniger, the executive director of the ACLU of Indiana. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the U.S. Constitution in anticipation of Constitution Day, which is tomorrow. My guest is Jane Henniger, who is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana, one of my old chops. We were talking beforehand about kind of the contentious parts of the Constitution. There are also, Jane, you were making the case that the Constitution, at least our understanding of it, has evolved over time. Can you give me an example?
Yeah, so the internment of Japanese during World War II, that's a great example of something that the government did in a time of war that now we are all aghast at. Most of you are talking about what people know about, what people learn in school. Almost every American child learns about the Japanese internment and how we all regret that that happened and that it was, everyone recognizes that was totally inconsistent with the values that are emanate and are the spirit of the Constitution. Yet at the time, the Japanese internment was totally uncontroversial. I shouldn't say totally uncontroversial. Controversial, by and large, for the vast majority of government, of judges, of citizens, and so accepted that it was accepted by the ACLU. At the time, there was an affiliate in Southern California, affiliate of the ACLU, that wanted to bring the case and said that internment of Japanese was mm-hmm. unconstitutional. And the national ACLU fought those lawyers bitterly, saying, no, this is something the government has to do. We shouldn't challenge that. And so there was this big fight. So even advocates like the ACLU that believe that they're all about the true core spirit of the ACLU don't get it right. I mean, the spirit of the Constitution don't get it right, that we all can be swayed by the urgency of the facts around us to think that, you know, these rights really need to take a back seat because of the urgency of the situation. And history has shown us time and time again that it's really rarely the case. The courts now have evolved this balancing test and looking at what's the benefit of curbing rights mm-hmm. and what are the cost? And we see that played out in most recently in our marriage equality case. Mm-hmm. The ACLU here in Indiana, across the country, are bringing cases for couples, same-sex couples who want the right and dignity of marriage in their lives. And the Seventh Circuit Court of decision in our case just came down a week or so ago. They talked about the cost and benefit, the cost to these people's lives, these couples' lives, and to their children's lives of denying them a fundamental right to marry and equal protection under the law, and waiting. What benefit does government get by denying this right? And that's a balance that we've had to ask over and over throughout history.
What is the, you know, the argument there often is that we would not see, there's nothing in the Constitution that speaks specifically to gay people, period, gay citizens. And that argument we often hear is the original intent one, and it's sort of a limited reading of the Constitution. There are people, obviously, out there who would quarrel with the idea that it is an evolving document, that we, you know, that we have to look at it simply as it was written and work from that spirit. What's your response to those folks?
Well, I think from my perspective, it's a simple one. Look whose rights were, who were protected by the Constitution in 1787. It wasn't women, mm-hmm. right? We didn't have the right to vote. It wasn't the slaves that were, the continuation of slavery was an implicit part of the bargain when the Constitution was signed into life. They weren't protected. And so many minority groups were left out of the understanding of the mm-hmm. Constitution, but thankfully not they weren't left out of the spirit of the Constitution. And so, you know, if you say that it's a stagnant, set in stone document, then you have to say, you know,
slavery is still acceptable.
Exactly.
Women don't get to vote or own property.
Exactly.
Or do all sorts
exactly.
of things.
And using marriage as an example, as recently as the 1960s, states all across this country had laws, often active laws, banning mm-hmm. interracial marriage. The court then said there's a fundamental right to marriage, that marriage is so is a unique bond between two people and permeates so much of our society that you have a fundamental right to marriage. That's not written in the Constitution, mm-hmm. but the Constitution over the years has been recognized to have a whole host of rights that emanate from the specific rights. So there was a right to privacy, and it's spelled out specifically in the Bill of Rights by, you know, no search and seizure. You don't have to quarter soldiers in your home if you don't want to. But there are other aspects of privacy, like the right to be able to purchase contraceptives, that have necessarily come from, as an understanding from the Constitution, as our understanding as a people has evolved. And thank goodness we evolve. It's been tens and thousands of years in the process, but our human understanding doesn't stand still. And the glory of the Constitution is that it's a sturdy enough document to embrace that expanding understanding.
We are talking about the Constitution in anticipation of Constitution Day tomorrow. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Shoot us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. You talked about sort of the nature of the way slavery was woven into the Constitution. When you talk about the history of the draft, I think a lot of people think that the Constitution was this kind of pristine document that, you know, was drafted and handed down somewhere from Olympus, rather than the fact that it's the product of some pretty hard-headed horse trading by very practical politicians in the 18th century. You talk about some of the deals that were woven into the drafting of it that made the whole thing possible.
Yeah, and I'm not a constitutional historian by any means, but a lot of us have heard the stories about, you know, the certain details in the Constitution as to representation concerning Congress and mm-hmm. That to appease the southern states so they could maintain and hold their power against the more populous East Coast colonies at that time. They all struck deals so that they could stay together as a unit. That was important to the horse trading, that these colonies all buy into this document and stand united in their effort. A lot of those deals that were struck, they're still in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
The
fact that we've got a Senate and a House of Representatives,
right?
That was to keep the Senate, with the idea that even there are states now that are smaller than some counties in our largest states, but they still get two U.S. senators. It's disproportionate representation in that case, but that was to keep the small states from thinking that they could be overwhelmed in a mere show of hands.
Right, and similarly in the powers for the president, there were some who believed that you had to have a powerful chief executive, and there were others who, you know, said, we've had that. It was mm-hmm. called a monarch, and it didn't turn out well at all for us. And so there were lots of fine details that were an attempt to appease everyone, or maybe appease no one, and thus find compromise that way. There was also the whole balance of power, mm-hmm. you know. So the courts and the legislature and the executive branch was designed to offer this very delicate balance with that one could cancel out the other, could cancel out the other, or they could all work in concert, but that they would be a check and balance on each other. And all of that was designed to give us maximum, we the citizens, we the people, a maximum ability to not only from the outset have control over our government, but to maintain it on an ongoing basis. I mean, really, I think that that's the real genius of the document, that it has survived without tinkering, not only on issues of rights and liberties, but also in some of the mechanics have been tinkered with over the years. Term limits for presidents is one of them. But that the basic framework has survived so largely intact is really, really quite something.
Yeah, I think it is, if I'm not mistaken, the world's oldest functioning constitution right now, and we're the world's at least written one. Obviously, the UK would argue that theirs is largely unwritten, that it's been in existence even longer. In terms of this idea that it is a living document, which means that we have to consider it afresh and without the spirit of reverence, take it out of the statue's hands, as it were, and make it breathe again. What are some things that the founders might have gotten wrong? I think probably the slavery compromise is one that we most indict right now.
Right.
We probably ought to talk a little bit about what that was to get the deal done.
Yeah, and you may have to help me with some of the details, but there was the issue of representation for purposes of determining how many representatives you had in Congress, that you counted your population, and every slave counted for three fifths of a vote.
Even though the slaves weren't allowed to vote, they weren't allowed to cast that three-fifths.
Right.
So,
in
effect, it also became an instrument for their subjugation became an instrument for even further subjugation. Their presence on the earth was used as an argument, political argument, for them, their masters, to solidify their control.
I think a lot of the compromise of looking the other way in slavery was just to no one had an inkling that any of those rights in the Constitution originally or appended to it, the Bill of Rights years later, that it would ever apply equally to African Americans was beyond imagining at the time that the Constitution was adopted.
Or women, for that matter.
Right, right.
We are talking about the Constitution here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits, WFYI, or on Twitter at WFYI. In terms of the areas that we now have sort of expanded the Constitution's reach. What do you think of as sort of the turning point when, we realized that the Constitution wasn't going to be almost every organization, every business or whatever has a mission statement and the Constitution is kind of a rough parallel there, that they spend a lot of time drafting and then they generally staple it up somewhere, and after that pretty much forget it exists. In this case, the Constitution is still, an actual living presence in our lives. What made that happen? What made it not be the thing that you could sort of put away and forget?
Yeah, I think constitutional scholars would probably say that early on, the first 100 years or so, the extent to which the Constitution was thought about, it was thought about in that structural way. What are the powers of the president? What are the powers of Congress? And debating over that in the courts and in the well of the legislature. Until the early 20th century, so about until the 1920s, there was almost no judicial at pronouncements on the meaning of the Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. You know, we think of them as so important, so fundamental: free speech, search and seizure, right to trial, right to counsel. We think of those as our God-given American rights, and yet they were hardly looked at. They were dusty in the figurative sense, and it was, just to put in this shameless plug, the ACLU that started the reawakening of the Constitution as to rights and liberties. So in the 1920, there were thousands of people put in jail for criticizing government at the time of war. Things now that John Stewart, Bill O'Reilly, mm-hmm. Rush Limbaugh, Stephen Colbert, they do every day, criticizing government, criticizing the president. In 1920, you could get thrown in jail for years for that same act. And so that really, getting the courts to recognize that the First Amendment really meant something, was what started the thaw of that document and started to breathe it back to life.
We are talking about the Constitution here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Art, welcome to the program.
Greetings. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to read a very, very short... The actual date of the ratification of the Constitution was July 25th, 1788. A lot of people think it happened in 1787. And it was... New York State was the last state that was necessary to pass, to vote, that could make it happen. Mm-hmm. Alexander Hamilton's speeches on and off the floor, our arm-twisting, were hailed by many. This is a quote now, footnote 619 from a book by a professor from Rutgers University. He argued, he remonstrated, he entreated, he warned, till apathy itself was moved, and the most relentless of human things, a preconcerted majority, was staggered and broken, said Reverend John Mason later. And so New York State broke the logjam. It was the 12th. And after that, I mean, Governor Clinton had walked across the aisle and sat down with Alexander Hamilton. And then 11 votes followed him. And that made a difference. And the final margin was 30 to 27. And four of the anti-federalists had just walked out the door and did not vote.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the step-by-step end of the story that made it possible the Constitution to be born.
Thanks very much for the call and the history, Art.
And the book is entitled Triumvirate, the Story of the Unlikely Alliance that Saved the Constitution and United the Nation by Bruce Chadwick.
Great. Thank you very much.
An interesting parallel to all that is that there was such a logjam at the time of the passage of the Constitution that it very nearly parallels situation that we're in today.
Yeah. Art, we're getting a little tight on time.
When the Federalists eased off on their pressure, all of a sudden everybody else came more towards the middle. That's what made it possible for Virginia and New York.
Thanks for calling us, Art. Thank you. We are talking about the Constitution here on No Limits. My guest is Jane Henniger, the Executive Director of the ACLU of Indiana. I am John Krall. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the Constitution in anticipation of Constitution Day tomorrow. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. My guest is Jane Henniger, who is the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana, my old shop. And we've gotten an email question from a regular listener named Jerry that's actually a quiz on the Constitution. He says, one of our state legislators recently agreed to take the attached quiz, a genuine act of political courage for which I must commend him very highly. The questions are based upon a plain reading of the actual text of the Constitution. I attempted to include no trick questions, although some may disagree with this characterization. The legislator got 3 right out of 10 by my interpretation of the correct answers. So it's a true-false quiz on the Constitution of the United States. Jane, are you game for doing this?
Okay. I hope I get...
You didn't realize
as long
that,
as I get more than 3, I'll...
Coming onto the program was an opportunity for ritual humiliation here, I guess. But the Constitution of the United States, 1, prohibits taking private property for public use. True or false?
Well, it's not so black and white, but prohibits... it does not prohibit it.
Okay. 2, grants criminal defendants the right to a trial by jury. True or false?
Yes.
True. Includes the word science, but does not include the word God.
The Constitution itself.
Yes.
I would say that that's true.
Guarantees the right to vote by secret ballot. True or false?
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay. Makes the federal government responsible for organizing and arming the militia.
I can see why, makes the government responsible for organizing the militia. I would say no, for the federal government, no.
Prohibits either house of Congress from adjourning during a session for more than 3 days without consent of the other house.
I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know.
And I've got to say, I wouldn't necessarily know these either. Requires that proposed constitutional amendments be ratified by 3/4 of the states within 10 years of their passage by Congress.
I think that's right.
Okay. It limits appropriation of money for the Army to 2 years at a time.
Oh, that sounds right. I don't know if it's right, but sounds like a good idea.
Requires representatives, when elected, be at least 25 years of age and a resident of the district they represent.
I would say that's true.
Okay. And requires the federal courts, including the Supreme Court, be composed of an uneven number of judges. I think we're assuming numerically
here. Well,
for the
Supreme Court, we know that's true. An unequal, sure, that would be logical. I'm not sure that's always right. But, yeah, sure.
All right, Jerry. I'm assuming you're out there keeping score. Shoot us a note and let us know how Jane did. I doubt I would have done any better. So
yeah, and
good quiz.
Right, and the question is whether my con law grade from law school can be revoked retroactively.
We are talking about the Constitution in anticipation of Constitution Day, which is tomorrow. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Gary did and reach out to us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. It says, on the issue of subjugation, I am interested in disability. That's his message.
I'm not
that
sure
whole
I know
idea
how to interpret
disability
that.
Rights, though, is one.
Right,
that,
right. And we, and at you know, that's an area that we do a lot of work at the ACLU and talk about those groups that were not thought of, let alone specifically omitted. They weren't even considered in the original drafting of the Constitution or even the Bill of Rights or individuals with disabilities. And that's something that we've, as a society, have had to evolve and recognize the need to encompass that viewpoint in our understanding of rights and liberties.
Not long ago, here in the state, we just hosted a gathering of some state legislators from around the country with the idea of revising the Constitution. What do you think of that idea?
I think it's tricky. I mean, it could be a good thing. It could be a dangerous thing. And I think that's been principally the main impediment to opening up the Constitution for ways that it should be adapted is because of the sort of the slippery slope. What else might happen if we open it up? There's a great book by Larry Sabato, or I don't know how you pronounce his
Sabato.
Name. Sabato. And when he looks on 10 or 15 different issues, ways that perhaps our society would function better, would work better if we reconsidered the framework that was originally set up by the Constitution. You know, the Constitution is our relationship to it really needs to be a balance of both reverence and, if not healthy skepticism, at least a healthy sense of challenge, and so that we keep it alive, but we protect it at the same time. There are democracies in this and around the world that change their constitutions as often as we change members of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Every 2 years, oh, every
there,
year,
there are
every
democracies
6 months.
That change constitutions as often as we change shirts. But
right.
That's a whole
right. And yeah. Certainly that's not good for society.
Yeah.
I mean, we really need stability, and one of the great benefits that government gives us, the reason why we enter into that contract that you were talking about, is the stability that government provides. So we can get on with our daily lives of doing our work and raising our families. And you can't have that stability if you never know what are the laws governing this or that on any particular date. At the same time, while we have that reverence, we need to keep a healthy view on whether things aren't right and whether we need to change our understanding.
If you'd like, we're talking about the Constitution and anticipation of Constitution Day tomorrow. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great program. And I will put in a shameless plug. I am a card-carrying member of the ACLU and am thrilled with the good work that they do.
Jane likes you already, so, yeah.
I'm in the car, so I don't have my reference, but I often quote this this quote. It's mythology or hopefully truth that Benjamin Franklin was approached leaving at the end of the day during the Constitutional Convention by a woman, and the woman supposedly said to him, "Well, doctor, what do we have, a monarch or a republic?" And he was reported to have said, "A republic, madame, if we can keep it." And I think that speaks to the spirit that Jane is talking about, that there is a spirit of this document that we have to work towards keeping it. And so I just really appreciate the comments and the thoughtful conversation that you're having today.
Thanks,
Debbie. I would mirror that with a quote from Learned Hand, a judge 150 years later after Benjamin Franklin. And he said that constitutions, laws are meaningless if the liberty that we pursue isn't in our hearts. And that if it's not there, then no law, no constitution, no court can save it. So I think that's the fundamental importance of something like Constitution Day, because if we don't care about it, if we don't value it and put it first and foremost, then all the constructs won't maintain it.
Thanks very much for the call, Debbie. Really appreciate it. Well, that's the other image, though, that came from that era is they referred to the Constitution, and it's a phrase that's actually burrowed its way into the American culture, is that it was a machine that would go of itself. To some degree, those Franklin's comment and then that one are in opposition, because at least what I hear Debbie saying, to some degree what you're saying is it won't go unless we make it go.
Right. Well, you know, it's only, you know, you can, if you take the machine analogy, if there's not someone to turn the switch and to maintain it, to oil it, to give it fuel, then it's not going to do its job.
Mm-hmm.
And just sitting there, these, you know, free speech or the right to and privacy, which is a huge issue now. With the challenge, both the potential, the great potential of technology, but the challenge it poses on the what we consider our private lives, if we don't challenge that and say, you know, liberty means this, and we want to be safe, but we want to protect this zone of privacy. In our lives, if we don't provide that oil or fuel or whatever you want to use for the metaphor, then government will be on its own volition. It'll be a machine that goes on its own, but perhaps in a direction that we don't like, or it'll run right over us.
gotten an email comment from a listener named Paul, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. He says, I am reading biographies of Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, and am struck by the battle between the two and the similarities to today's political environment. On one side was Washington, Hamilton, and Adams advocating for a strong central government, the other, Jefferson, Madison, and others working for a small government. We've been fighting this battle from the beginning. How much of that, you know, this idea that a lot of that, there are really no new issues in American history, there are just new faces on the same issues, is true?
Yeah, and again, that's part of the glory of the Constitution. We feel at times that 227 years is a long time, but it's a blink of the eye, and human nature hasn't changed much in that time. And I think that there are lots of healthy tensions in our government and our political life. And that's one of them, the small versus big, the varying viewpoints of the role of government in our lives. I think it's incredibly healthy to have those discussions. Those are discussions that we have all the time in our work at the ACLU. We find ourselves on all kinds of sides of the issue, but we're always on the side of the Constitution. And when we are worried about privacy and surveillance, we're aligned with people who are worried about a government that's too large, that permeates into too much of our individual lives. On other times, we're on the side of individuals that want rights expounded and more clearly delineated. So, we believe that the Constitution has set sort of that spirit, but that it's always a matter of playing out the tensions. One of the great things about the Constitution is that it allows us to ask questions, that not every country, not every government has this great setup where we citizens can ask the questions of our government, can you do that? And we are allowed a fair chance at a objective response. And we at the ACLU often ask the question, and we really don't know the answer. It may be that government's doing something that's perfectly constitutional, and it's the right balance of costs and benefits and balances, but we won't know until we ask the question. And there are very few people who ask the question. There's the ACLU, I would propose, and a free and active press. Mm-hmm. And from design, I can't say that the founders envisioned an American Civil Liberties Union, but they certainly envisioned a healthy press that would continue to ask those questions and hold government accountable and see that it's as transparent as possible.
We are talking about the Constitution here on No Limits. Dash, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Coming from the context that it seems like individuals always are the ones, for the most part, that have to test the Constitution to find out what our liberties are. Who would be the top three constitutional heroes that you can think of in our history, our nation's history, that were people that stood up and established and confirmed our rights as citizens? And I guess that's all I have to ask.
Great question. Thanks
that
very much for the
awesome,
call,
Dash. Awesome question. Well, I would say, and Jen, you may have some of your own heroes. Mm-hmm. I would say the earliest hero is James Madison himself. Mm-hmm. He's not only the author, but the political force behind the adoption of the Bill of Rights. He was the one that helped draft them, talked about with his colleagues about what might be missing and the pros and cons about delineating those rights explicitly. There was a danger that if you write out the rights and list them, then the assumption is that that's all, right? And some scholars have made that assumption. Though if you read what James Madison was saying at the time, is he assured
Thomas Jefferson.
Right, and others that say, no, we'll list them out, and those are the and the rest will not be excluded by omission, but these are the core ones that we need to make sure are there. So I would say he was a first hero. Then, you know, some of the plaintiffs who stepped forward over the course of our history, and I think limiting them to 2 or 3 or even 100 would be too difficult. And some of these plaintiffs have been so brave. I mean, I mentioned the Korematsu case and that Japanese internment, and he had a whole country going against him, and a lot of right-thinking people going against him. So, I mean, without the plaintiffs who are willing to stand up and risk being a pariah in their own community. You know, we talked about sort of the controversial nature of the Constitution. A lot of these plaintiffs, now they're heroes, but when they stood up, they were seen as malcontents and pariahs.
We have been talking about the Constitution in anticipation of U.S. Constitution Day. Before we go, I'm sure people obviously are very interested in this. Is there a place they can go on your website to find more information? Can you give them the URL real quickly, Jane?
Absolutely. So we can be found at www.aclu-in.org, and our Constitution Day materials can be found on our website, and more information about our activities as well as information about the Constitution. And then ACLU.org talks about the work of the ACLU across the country.
Good last word. Jane Henniger, thank you very much for joining us. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thanks for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.